Well, this is the last Sabbath that I'll be able to speak to you before the Passover. We will be in Gainesville next Sabbath, so I'll be able to talk to them about what I plan to give to you today, next week there. Because this is the last time that I'll get to speak to you before Passover, there's something in particular that I really wanted to focus on today, and that is the last hours of Jesus Christ's life that went in his physical form here on earth. And I'd like to do that, take us back mentally 1993 years ago from essentially 1 week from today, the last 24 hours or so of Jesus Christ's life. The year was 31 AD, and as we go through the sermon, I would like to ask you to try to imagine what it would be like to be in the position that Jesus Christ was in at that time. I think the more we think about this, the more value we will draw from the Passover and the sacrifice that was made on our behalf. Jesus knew that he was going to suffer horribly and die within a matter of hours. Think for just a moment, what would your mental state be if you knew that was going to happen to you? Where would your mind be? What would it be consumed with? He had mentioned to his disciples earlier that he would die at the hands of man. But they didn't believe him. It was not something he discussed often, as he didn't want to unduly trouble his followers. However, Jesus knew that it was important for the disciples to hear from him the truth of his soon coming death. He never intended for them to be caught completely off guard without any prior warning to his death. On his last journey towards Jerusalem, he spoke to his disciples, and I'd like to turn over to Luke chapter 18 now, and let's begin to read what he shared. Luke 18 and verse 31 says that he took the 12 aside and said to them, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and all things that are written by the prophets concerning the Son of Man will be accomplished." There had been a lot written, but also a lot that had not been understood. Understanding comes from God's revelation. I believe that we all understand that, but it generally comes little by little as one becomes more capable of understanding. Experience is a factor, but one's eyes have to be opened miraculously by God, as is mentioned in context here. I think all of us can relate to the fact, and you've certainly heard me say before, when we are baptized, in one sense, it's not unlike being on square go in the game of Monopoly. Now, unlike going around the board to collect $200, we're moving forward from that time for something far greater prize, and that is to be a member of God's family, eternally living in his family. So let's pick up in verse 32. "For he will be delivered to the Gentiles and will be mocked and insulted and spit upon. They will scourge him and kill him, and the third day he will rise again." Now, these words that we're reading here are very plain from Jesus Christ and should have been easy enough to understand. Yet, the disciples did not understand. They could not reconcile, let's say, to the false notion that they had of the Messiah. They could not conceive how he, who should redeem Israel, would allow himself to be tortured and killed. Why would he do that? In some translations, verse 34 states they could not grasp, and that is definitely true. They could not grasp what they were being taught here. I'm going to ask you something because I believe you'll be able to relate to this. Think about times in your life when somebody shared something with you, and perhaps you thought you heard what they were saying, but you didn't really grasp it until later. And it dawned on you later that you didn't really grasp it until later. That's what we see and as we read this experience here with the disciples. They saw him exercise great power in performing miracles. They knew he had unlimited power. Christ's death could not be squeezed into their preconceived ideas. No, somehow he would call upon angels to intervene or whatever needed to be done was the thought process there. It can easily be seen how one's mind has to be open to understand simple truth, can't it? One of the things that I have thought about for years, I'm sure many of you have as well, is something that on the one hand is hard to believe and on the other makes complete sense because you recognize that in order to see God's truth, it is truly a calling that must take place. But the concept and the idea, for example, of somebody who devotes their life to writing about the Bible, say, for example, authors of commentaries, entire volumes that they spend hours and weeks and months and years putting together, and yet they can't connect the dots to see and understand God's plan. Because God hasn't called them, no matter how much research they've done. Now, you and I can look at something like that and then begin to say, okay, I see how this works even here in the case of the disciples. So again, God has to reveal the truth. That's the bottom line. This explains why they were so muddled in their thinking and so confused when Christ was killed. To their way of thinking, Jesus should have called legions of angels, struck down everyone that threatened to harm him. Jesus spoke of his death several times before, but earlier he couched what he said in mystical language. He spoke of a temple which, if destroyed, he would raise again in 3 days. If they couldn't understand plain, clear words, as we just read here in Luke 18, they certainly couldn't understand vague words. So often he made comments or referred to prophecies which he knew people didn't understand at the time. Some did later, others never did. At another time, he referred to a lifting up of the Son of Man like a brazen serpent in the wilderness. Once again, those words were meaningless to them, and yet on the other occasions of a sad separation of the bridegroom from the children of the bride chamber, of the giving of his flesh from the life of the world or for the life of the world, and of a sign like that of the prophet Jonas, which would be given through his death and resurrection in 3 days. Now, here, Jesus spoke more plainly. He wanted to be sure they were sufficiently well-grounded before he spoke to them so plainly. God opens our eyes to different things, and he may open doors for us, but he waits for us to walk through before he then can give what's next, perhaps, for us. I think we can all very much relate to that in our own lives, so it would make sense what I'm sharing with you here. In Matthew chapter 16, in verse 16, Peter had just acknowledged that Jesus was the Christ, the Son of the living God. Let's turn over here to Matthew chapter 16. In Matthew 16, and let's pick up, I'll just share what I was reading there a moment ago, in verse 16. Simon Peter answered and said, You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered, verse 17, and said to him, Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. Even Peter, who was with him for 3.5 years, would not have understood if God had not revealed it to him. Very important. Cannot overemphasize this. So this was the right time now to speak plainly of his death. To do so earlier would have been too early. Jesus' timing is always perfect. Again, God reveals truth little by little. It was time to begin to talk plainly about his death, even though his disciples did not understand. Jesus explained why in John chapter 14. Hold your place here in Matthew 16, and let's turn over to John chapter 14 for a moment. John 14, and we'll take a look at verse 29. Jesus Christ says, "Now I have told you before it comes, that when it does come to pass, you may believe." So by the time Jesus ascended to heaven, as recorded in Acts 1, the disciples understood the plan of God and were ready to go and teach. Finally, the disciples' concept of messiahship moved out into this new dimension. Matthew 16 records that when Jesus first spoke plainly about his forthcoming death, Peter rebuked him. Let's notice verse 22 as we go back to Matthew chapter 16. Peter took him aside, began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you." Now again, you can't help in one sense but chuckle to a certain degree about Peter. Not unlike what he said to Jesus Christ when it came time to have his feet washed. "You'll never wash my feet." To which then Christ rebuked him as well. Once again, "You have nothing to do with me if I don't wash your feet." Peter meant well here in verse 22. But he was dead wrong. Think about this for a moment. Peter's rebuke triggered a return rebuke from Jesus Christ. Jesus didn't just let Peter's words go by without correcting them. Just meaning well is not acceptable. Lots of people, quote unquote, mean well. God's looking for those who do well. Verse 23, his response was, he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are an offense to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." Now, I stop right there, I read that, and I think to myself, ouch. That right there would be difficult to hear, wouldn't it? Jesus did not hesitate to make it known to Peter that he was out of step. His thinking was carnal thinking, not God's thinking. But how else was Peter going to know unless it was pointed out to him? You see, Jesus said that if one is to follow him, he had to deny self. Self-interest was out of the question. It was the way of the devil, not the way of God. It's easy to see how human Peter was. All we human beings do a degree of this in life, which is why the pursuit, Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever, in Hebrews 13:8, is the objective and goal. Instead of this, to actually be able to live life in a way without those dips. That requires thinking that we human beings don't have apart from God's Holy Spirit, and a receptiveness to let him and allow that Spirit to work in us to change exactly everything that we think and how and why we do what we do. Peter expressed the most intense affection with his words, yet he was inconsistent in his thinking. He was like a child spiritually, lacked true wisdom. When we first start out in this walk, we're very childlike in many ways. Sometimes people, and I get this, we want to do things the best that we know how. But we lack balance until we have more experiences in life and come to realize this is more balanced. Just like when we're children physically and we're learning certain things and maybe zealous and fired up about something, and mom and dad are kind of going, oh boy, I remember that stage and day in life, and boy, I've learned how to be much more balanced now. He couldn't bear the thought of any harm befalling his teacher. Peter couldn't. And yet he would be disrespectful in his rebuke of him. There are a number of examples in the Bible which show Peter's imperfections. He was not constant in his words or behavior, but frankly, that's the way man is, isn't he? Jesus had heard from Satan himself at the beginning of his ministry much the same advice that Peter expressed. Consider this. It was in essence this: save yourself at any cost, sacrificing duty to self-interest. Personal advantage and honor is the important thing. This is what Satan wants us to buy into. What better way to use your divine powers and privileges, he might say to Christ, than to promote your own advantages and glory? You deserve them. You're entitled to them. What's that sound like? Doesn't that sound like a lot of people today? You're special. You should use that. You be you. Follow your heart. Peter really believed Jesus should use his supernatural power to protect himself. But as we know, this was not the Father's will. It was not in his plan. Peter, of course, was ignorant of God's plan at this time, however. What we see here is Christ was not one who pleased himself. Note to self, I need to make sure I learn from that example. Peter did not understand why. If Jesus was right, why didn't he please himself? Why should he sacrifice himself? He's so powerful. Why is he doing this? There were a lot of things Peter did not understand. He and the other disciples had a lot to learn, just as you and I learn a lot over time with the help of God's Holy Spirit. Reminds me of what we find in Isaiah 55. Let's turn there for a moment. This is a passage that I believe many are familiar with, and it really does speak directly to what I'm talking about here. Isaiah 55 and verse 8 says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than yours, and my thoughts than your thoughts." I don't think you can overstate this. The truth is, this has always been a problem with man. Sadly, he isn't wise enough to recognize it. This is so much of what I see in today's world and occasionally in God's church as well. Finally, after the resurrection, some things came together for the disciples. And after receiving God's Spirit, they were to think more like God, though still in a limited way, because, of course, they were not God, nor are we. But we'll pick up the story of the New Testament Passover now in Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22, we'll be hopping around a little bit between the different gospel accounts for the remainder of the sermon time that I have with you today. Luke chapter 22 and beginning in verse 7, "Then came the day of unleavened bread when the Passover must be killed." Now I think I don't have the time now to go into and explain, I think most of you are aware, there's a little bit of interchangeable use of the day of unleavened bread and the word Passover. So I don't want that to confuse you. I'm sure if you've done study on this before, you understand and recognize that. But rather than take time to do that, I want to continue reading. "He sent Peter and John, saying, 'Go and prepare the Passover for us, that we may eat.' So they said to him, 'Where do you want us to prepare?' And he said to them, 'Behold, when you have entered the city, a man will meet you carrying a pitcher of water. Follow him into the house which he enters.'" So it was part of God's plan for Jesus Christ to die at Jerusalem. Jesus had said earlier that he must go to Jerusalem. You can find that in Matthew chapter 23 and verse 37 for those of you who take notes. Continuing the story here in verse 11, "Then you shall say to the master of the house, the teacher says to you, 'Where is the guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples?' Then he will show you a large furnished upper room. There, make ready." So they went and found it just as he had said to them, and they prepared the Passover. It's quite possible some of the food and wine was purchased by Judas earlier in the day. If so, he would have been free to consult the chief priests and others without the disciples' knowledge, because, of course, he would betray Christ. There would have been no need for an explanation of his being in the city by himself. Of course, that's merely speculation, but something interesting to consider nonetheless. Verse 14 says, "When the hour had come, he sat down and the 12 apostles with him." So when Jesus entered the upper room, he must have seemed, frankly, very sober to his disciples. He knew he would die soon. Once again, think about the mindset that he would have had, to the best of our ability, the mindset you would have if you knew what was about to happen. He was dreading the trauma that he was about to go through. Verse 15. "He said to them, 'With fervent desire, I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer.'" Here we see that he again mentions he must suffer. As you think about what we're reading here, how much of this do you think was actually sinking into the disciples? What's he saying? Why does he keep saying this? The suffering was more imminent now. The opportunity to talk with his disciples were decreasing. It was important that he talk about his upcoming death with his disciples, as it was not registering in their minds. Again, I believe we can all very much relate to this, because there are so many times, I think, in life, or at least a certain number of times, where something just didn't really sink in until later. If they would have understood what's shared in Isaiah 52 and Isaiah 53, they would have had much more feeling for him that evening. Probably the best word to describe them is confused at this point. Why does he keep saying this? Now, before going further in Luke, let's review these scriptures in Isaiah 52. Let's go to Isaiah 52 first. Isaiah 52, and I'd like to pick up in verse 13. "Behold, my servant shall deal prudently. He shall be exalted and extolled and be very high." There's a reference to the great Redeemer, this is, who would eventually be given rulership over all the world. Verse 14 says, "Just as many were astonished at you, so his visage was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men." Now, if you have a reference column in your Bible, you will see that the term visage means appearance. In other words, many were shocked, or would be shocked, at his appearance. He hardly appeared to be a man. There was no way they could reconcile such a person with the Messiah. They thought, how could anyone be so beaten, presumed to be the Messiah? These things seemed so inconsistent, yet they are true. Chapter 53. Now let's see, verse 15. "So shall he sprinkle many nations, kings shall shut their mouths at him, for what had not been told them they shall see, and what they had not heard they shall consider." They would never have conceived such things before. Continuing in chapter 53, verse 1, "Who has believed our report? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" In other words, who would understand what God had in mind for the great Redeemer, the Messiah? What man would believe, even if you told or were even if told or given a report about God's plan for the one who would ultimately be greatly exalted? Who would have believed that he would be despised and rejected before being exalted? Who would have thought that the Messiah's role in delivering man would be in two stages? The first, of course, coming to die, and the second, coming to rule in glory. How could anyone ever know these things without being revealed to them by God's Spirit? It's one thing to read a written report, but an entirely different thing to recognize it is true and understand it. Verse 2, the first phrase says, "For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant." He seems so insignificant. Who would recognize him? Next phrase says, "And as a root out of dry ground." You know, one would not expect a root in dry ground to produce anything. Isn't there a need for moisture? Likewise, no one expected this man to produce anything of significance. How could he be the Messiah? Jesus Christ actually came from royalty. However, there was no recognition of that when he had such a humble birth and upbringing. Continuing in verse 2, it says, "He has no form." That is, he had no external glory that one would expect from the Messiah. Barnes Notes points out the word form refers to the state of abasement rather than to his own personal beauty. Again, when you think royalty, do you think what we're reading here? No. The next phrase says, "or comeliness." Comeliness translated honor, glory, majesty in other places. Deuteronomy 33:17, Psalm 29:4, and Daniel 11, verse 20. And excellency in Isaiah 35:2. In short, there was nothing in his appearance that would indicate he was the Messiah. You and I would know if King Charles came in to the room. First of all, we know what he looks like, but he would be wearing something that would indicate he's not going to come running in here in shorts and t-shirt. Right? I don't expect to come running here either, anyway, under any other condition, but you understand what I'm saying. So there's nothing in his appearance that would indicate he was the Messiah. The verse continues, "When we see him, there's no beauty that we should desire him." Simply put, he looked like an ordinary man. There was nothing about him that would particularly catch your eye. I remember one time years ago, in fact, this was when Colleen and I were dating or maybe had gotten engaged. It was around that time frame. And we were at a Dodgers game one time. And there were some people in front of us, right, sitting right in front of us, that were getting autographs from some young kids. And the lady behind us, I hear her whisper to the person behind us, and we both heard the same thing. "Who's he? Is he somebody?" Trying to figure out who it was. And I thought to myself, well, I'm somebody. It's interesting that there's not one word about his appearance in the New Testament. Royalty often appears in regal dress, pomp, and splendor. He did not. He was not what they expected. God obviously did not want any pictures or painting of him passed on. We will not know, at least in this age, what he looked like as a human. Continuing in verse 3, "He is despised and rejected by men." He was forsaken, left destitute by men. These are harsh words, fellow family members. It's hard for us to get the real sense and meaning of them. You and I, knowing what we know now, in one sense would like to think, boy, if I could just go back and be there knowing what I know now. Doesn't change anything, of course, but if we were in their shoes, we wouldn't have known either. Barnes explains, and I quote, "The idea is undoubtedly somehow that of ceasing from men or from being regarded as belonging to men. There was a ceasing or a withdrawing of that which usually appertains to man and which belongs to him. And the thought probably is that he was not only despised, but that there was an advance on that there was a ceasing to treat him as if he had human feelings and was in any way entitled to human fellowship and sympathy." You know, people are respecters of persons, aren't they? Well, I need to pay attention to and respect this person because they have money, because they have this, that, whatever it might happen to be. Somebody else doesn't have anything that we don't deem as that important or relevant. I need to pay attention to them. That's how it typically works with human beings, doesn't it? Which was part of the whole process that the Father and Jesus Christ put together, the Father and the Word, to be able to say, this is why it needs to happen this way. Continuing in Barnes' quote, it says, "It does not refer, therefore, so much to the active means employed to reject him as to the fact that he was regarded as cut off from man, and the idea is not essentially different from this, that he was the most abject and vile of mortals in the estimation of others, so vile as not to be deemed worthy of the treatment due to the lowest of men," end of quote. I don't know how vivid your imagination is, but it's hard to imagine something this horrendous. It's astounding that God would allow this to happen. But he did. It was all designed to help us realize the love of God for man. No greater price has been paid for anything. Now, hopefully, we don't lose sight of that when we partake of the bread and wine, representing his broken body and shed blood. Continuing in verse 3 here of chapter 53, says, "A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief." In other words, his whole life was full of suffering. He was familiar with sorrow and calamity because he experienced them. Continuing, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised. People just turned away from him in horror and contempt. And we did not esteem him. In other words, he was esteemed as nothing, of no value. This really makes you think about Christ's sacrifice when you think about what we're reading here. Verse 4 says, "Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted." It was assumed that he deserved it, that he died for his own sins, yet how wrong that was. He died for the sins of man, and he should be greatly appreciated for this. Verse 5, "He was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement for our peace was upon him, and by his stripes we are healed." He was completely 100% innocent. He did not sin one time. Verse 6 says, "All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." You ever doubt this? Even when you are a giver, what's our natural thing if we just kind of had our choice and it didn't really matter, or we would say in our minds doesn't matter? Then let's do something that I enjoy doing. That would be the natural proclivity of most human beings. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? And so they go back and forth because they're hesitant to say, but you know in their minds, well, here's what I really like to do. Just don't want to say it. It's a truly remarkable part of the Bible. How different is this than the mentality of man? Man all too often sees himself as a victim and therefore feels justified in wrong thinking or behavior. God does not subscribe to victimhood. Boy, I'm telling you today in the world, this world subscribes to victimhood. I'm a victim. I've been wronged. Having a conversation this week, actually, a member called me. They're dealing with a challenging trial. Their head wasn't in a good place. And they were distraught. They were down low. And they knew they weren't in a good place. Had another email come through a little later from the person after we had talked and the person had opportunity to think. And the person said, "What in the world was I thinking? Here we are in the time of preparation for the Passover, and I'm supposed to be considering and paying attention to what Jesus Christ did for me, and I'm feeling woe is me." I was really happy to read that particular email, not because of what they were going through. On the other hand, the learning that was there was priceless. This world is a lot of woe is me. This concept alone helps drive home the importance of making sure we don't take on the ways of this world, which is always seemingly looking to play the victim card. "Mr. Winter, you just don't understand. I don't know how to tell you how bad this really is." Do you think if someone came to you and said, "Well, you couldn't understand because you've never been a drug addict," that you would need to be a drug addict to understand what's right and wrong, what you should or shouldn't do? I don't think you'd have to be a drug addict. But some people use that as a cop-out or an excuse to not do what needs to be done. So instead, let me say, "Well, you couldn't possibly understand because you haven't walked in my shoes." That's man. Jesus Christ thinks so differently. Verse 8, "He was taken from prison and from judgment, and he who declares or will declare his generation, he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people, he was stricken." Verse 9 says, "And they made his grave with the wicked, but with the rich at his death, because he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He's put him to grief. When you made his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed, he shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. He shall see the labor of his soul and be satisfied by his knowledge. My righteous servant shall justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities." Verse 12 says, "Therefore I will divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul unto death. And he's numbered with the transgressors, and he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors." What a tremendous example. And as we come in a little over a week from now to keep and to partake of the Passover, it's very important that we consider what we're reading here and the mindset, the love that goes far beyond regular comprehension, frankly, on our behalf. Because of what he did, we can have eternal life. It is crucial that we respond in love and appreciation as we come before the Father and our elder brother to take the Passover. So after reading this, let's now return to Luke chapter 22, where we were earlier. Excuse me, Luke chapter 22. And let's read verse 16. "For I say to you, I will no longer eat of it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God." So at this point, the disciples must have partially realized some great crisis was at hand. Jesus Christ was sorrowful. His manner would have set the mood for the others. And even though they could see that Jesus was especially somber, and they had been told numerous times that he would die, they did not get the picture. They were really like children, gifted with exorbitant faith. They were still sure that when it became necessary that Jesus would summon legions of angels who would decimate his enemies and he would then establish the kingdom over all the nations. Jesus wanted the disciples to understand that his death was part of God's plan. It was not something terribly wrong. He did not want them to regard it as a calamity contrary to God's will. It was a part of his mission. And while he was being killed by man at the same time, he was allowing it voluntarily. Let's now continue the story by going back to Matthew chapter 26. As I said, we're skipping back and forth here in different gospel accounts, Matthew chapter 26. Now, I'm going to read from the New Revised Standard Version here and for some of what in the foreseeable sections that we'll be reading here. Matthew 26, certainly encourage you to read along, though, in whatever translation you have in front of you. And beginning in verse 21, while they were eating, he said, "Truly I tell you, one of you will betray me." And they became greatly distressed and began to say to him, one after another, "Surely not I, Lord." And he answered, "The one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it was written of him, but woe to that one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that one not to have been born." Now, stop for just a moment and think about this. If you're one of the disciples, what is he saying? Somebody in this room is going to betray. Where's this coming from? Can't imagine hearing words such as this. I don't believe there's anything more terrible that could be said about any human being since those words came from the lips of the Son of God. The Son of Man goes as is written to him, but woe to the one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better that that one not have been born. Since those words came from the lips of the Son of God, they were certainly true. Verse 25, Judas, who betrayed him, said, "Surely not I, Rabbi," he replied. "You have said so." Let's now move to John's account in chapter 13. John 13. Once again, I'll continue with the New Revised Standard Version. Beginning in verse 23. One of his disciples, the one whom Jesus loved, was reclining next to him. Simon Peter therefore mentioned to him to ask Jesus of whom he was speaking. So while reclining next to Jesus, he asked him, "Lord, who is it?" Jesus answered, It is the one to whom I give this piece of bread when I have dipped it in the dish." So when he had dipped the piece of bread, he gave it to Judas, son of Simon Iscariot. And after he received the piece of bread, Satan, notice not a demon himself, but Satan, entered into him. And Jesus said to him, "Do quickly what you are going to do." Jesus told him essentially, "Get out." He wanted to spend his last hours in the tender, confidential fellowship of his faithful ones without the presence of the deadly enemy. He did not wait until it pleased Judas to leave. He asserted his authority over Judas. When Jesus gave Judas the sop, which is the flesh of the lamb, a piece of unleavened bread and bitter herbs wrapped together, Jesus said, in effect, "That which you do, do quickly." It was an order to go and go at once. So Judas left immediately. What Judas did was not an act done in a moment of passion or insanity, although not sure how he could be of right mind either. Instead, the plans were laid. We know he couldn't have been of right mind because Satan took over, as we just read. His deed was quietly and deliberately planned. Matthew 26 and verse 16, as well as Mark 14 and verse 11, both record, quote, "He waited for the opportune hour." The NIV says Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. How uneasy Judas must have been that evening, sitting with Jesus and the others. He knew what he planned and may have wondered if Jesus suspected what he was about to do. He certainly would have pretended that everything was fine. There are a number of movies that I've watched over my lifetime, not unlike, I'm sure, all of you. I'm not big on promoting movies per se, because whenever you do, there's always something that later you're like, oh, I forgot about that part. So I'm not going to give you the name of this movie because I don't want to get myself in trouble here. But I'm going to tell you that I watched a movie many years ago. Colleen and I watched it together. And I always thought that this was one of the best movies I had ever seen because of how it ended. The movie was all about trying to catch somebody. And in the process, what got you is all the way up to the end, the person that you were pulling for to get away and the person they were pursuing was an agent, double agent. And you get to the end, you're like, I did not see that coming. I can't imagine Judas sitting in there trying to hold in whatever he was going to share. And I equally can't imagine what it would have been like for the other disciples to be absolutely blown away at what just happened here when it was all said and done. Judas must not have believed Jesus was the Messiah, because it was not logical to realize he was the Savior of mankind, the very Son of God, and still betray him. It was hard to understand how they could deny the miracles that he saw, even the resurrection of Lazarus. Perhaps he thought it was done by Egyptian magic. I don't know, but maybe he thought Jesus was a misguided religious fanatic. He should have known that he was not a fraud. He was too good of a person for that, and he probably thought Jesus really believed that he was the Son of God. Yet the mind of Judas, because it was darkened by his lusts, could not contain the truth that Jesus was who he claimed to be. After Judas left, Jesus proceeded to give the disciples the bread and wine. Let's pick up the story back in Matthew chapter 26. Matthew 26, and picking up in verse 31, once again I will read from the NRSV. Then Jesus said to them, "You will all become deserters because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I'm raised up, I will go ahead of you to Galilee." Peter said to him, "Though all became deserters because of you, I will never desert you." Jesus said to him, "Truly I tell you, this very night before the cock crows, you will deny me three times." Peter said to him, "Even though I must die with you, I will not deny you." And so said all the disciples. Once again, very Peter. No way. I'm not going to do that. Mm-mm. They all meant well. They just didn't have the character at that point to carry out what they said. The time came when they did, but this was not that time. Well, the meeting that Passover evening must have lasted a few hours, and then after this, Jesus Christ went out and prayed. Matthew 26, picking up in verse 36, Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." So he took with him Peter and two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and agitated. The two sons of Zebedee did. And he said to them, "I am deeply grieved, even to death. Remain here and stay awake with me." Now we can't imagine what he was going through, the burden he was carrying. He knew what horrendous things were just ahead of him. He was under great stress. Let me give you, for those of you who are note takers, I'm going to read two different passages here. You don't need to turn there with me. One is in John 12 and verse 27, and it says, "Now my soul is troubled, and what should I say? Father, save me from this hour." No, it is for this reason that I have come to this hour. And then in Luke 22, and the verses that include verses 39 through 48, it is shared in that context. "He came out and went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him." Now back to verse 40 of Matthew 26. "When he reached the place, he said to them, 'Pray that you may not come into the time of trial.' Then he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, knelt down and prayed, 'Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me, yet not my will, but yours be done.'" Continually, the focus was on the Father. Your will be done. See, that's the thought process that he was really trying to convey and teach to the disciples that might have sunk in, and probably and most likely did, later after Jesus Christ was gone and the New Testament church was founded. "Then an angel from heaven appeared to him and gave him strength." Do you think he would have needed that? Without a doubt. "In his anguish, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down to the ground." That is intensity. Verse 45 says, "When he got up from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping because of grief. And he said to them, 'Why are you sleeping? Get up and pray that you may not come into the time of trial.'" They just were not able to appreciate where Christ was and what was going on, anywhere near to the degree, obviously, of Christ himself. Other gospel writers say he prayed the same way three times. Verse 47 says, "While he was still speaking, suddenly a crowd came, and one called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them, and he approached Jesus to kiss him. And Jesus said to him, 'Judas, is it with a kiss that you are betraying the Son of Man?'" Again, such powerful words. Verse 55, "Then Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple police and the elders who had come for him, 'Have you come out with swords and clubs as if I were a bandit?'" You know, this group, consider who's in this group. This group included chief priests, captains of the temple, and the elders. The chief priests and elders were his judges. And of course, they were also the ones who bribed Judas. They should have been the ones to support him rather than trying to get rid of him. It was all illegal. There was no formal charge of any crime, no warrant for his arrest, no statement of what he had done. They just simply took him. John 18. Really helps to go back through this, I believe, before we come to partake of the Passover service. When I give this next week in Gainesville, of course, we'll be within that little window, essentially, of within 24 hours or so of taking the Passover. I think it resonates tremendously today and even more in one sense then as we read about the final hours of Christ's life. John 18, beginning in verse 12, I'll go back to the New Revised Standard. "So the soldiers, their officer, and the Jewish police arrested Jesus and bound him. First, they took him to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest, that year." By the way, it's important to note a few things. Consider the following as we go through and read what we're reading here and what we have been reading. It's important to note that the preliminary examination was illegal because it was a private proceeding that took place at night. Jewish law prohibited all proceedings by night. All proceedings that were private or secret examinations. They all knew this, but they didn't care. No one can claim these are innocent mistakes. There is no question about their hatred exhibited for the Son of God. From Annas, they took him to Caiaphas, as we're told in Matthew 26 and verse 57. By the way, the Sanhedrin originated the charges, which were also illegal by Jewish law. Just one thing after another. Now you can look it up on your own. But in Matthew 26 and verse 60, you can read that, quote, many false witnesses came forward. Many false witnesses. Don't know if they were paid. You know, certainly wouldn't surprise me. Maybe there was pressure. Maybe there were threats. You know, I mean, today we have people who are paid money to go and protest. So that certainly wouldn't be anything new, I don't think. Interestingly, the false witnesses, which actually had been sought, contradicted each other. Imagine that. That, however, did not matter to the high priest. It's very clear when you take the time to put the last hours of Christ's life together that there was significant scheming and conniving of deceitful men taking place. Some had to know that this was wrong. Now, there are people today that know different things are wrong, but for whatever reason, they choose to be silent. Back to Matthew 26. Pick up in verse 63 this time, Matthew 26, beginning in verse 63. Jesus was silent. Then the high priest said to him, I put you under oath before the living God. Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God. Jesus said to him, you have said so. But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, he is blasphemed. Why do we still need witnesses? You've now heard his blasphemy. What's your verdict? They answered, he deserves death. They charged him with blasphemy and pronounced him guilty. Verse 67 says, they spat in his face and struck him, and some slapped him, saying, prophesy to us, you Messiah, who is it that struck you? Remember where we began today in Luke 18? And we read that what we just read right here would happen. They abused him just as had been prophesied. All this happened at night. Yet the law for the Sanhedrin stated, quote, let a capital offense be tried during the day, but suspended at night. So not only did this happen at night, which was against the law, let me draw your attention to another violation of their own law. It was against the law for the Sanhedrin to try a capital offense on a day before an annual Sabbath. When was this? This was the Passover, the day before the first day of unleavened bread. An annual holy day. Still another illegal act. The trial of Jesus was concluded in one day. That too was forbidden by law. None of these things mattered. Not to these people who were determined to see Christ killed. There seemed to be no end of illegal acts by those in authority. The trial of Jesus was completed in less than 9 hours after his arrest. How many trials are you aware of that last 9 hours? It kind of reminds me of the movie scene, you know, the angry mob. Hang them, string them up. It was all done in private, secretly, so there would not be any witnesses who could testify on his behalf. Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus were friends of Christ and would have testified on his behalf. But Caiaphas and his henchmen kept their plans from those who might block them. That, too, of course, was illegal. Moving on in the story, as we know, Jesus was taken to Pilate. Luke chapter 23. Luke 23. Luke 23 and verse 1 shares, the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. But after talking with Jesus, Pilate could find no guilt in him. Skip down to verse 4. So Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." Verse 7. As soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. So now Jesus is sent to Herod. Verse 11. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. And as we know, he was then returned to Pilate. Let's pick up the story in John chapter 18. John 18, let's see, verse 35. Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." And Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you king then?" Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Verse 38, Pilate said to him, "Well, what is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "Look, I find no fault with him at all." Pilate truly wanted to release Jesus. So he thought that if he would have him scourged, perhaps, that the Jews would relent and Pilate would let him go. Chapter 19, verse 1. So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. Now let me stop for just a moment and share with you that Roman scourging was called halfway death. And it was called halfway death because it was supposed to stop just this side of death. Sounds horribly gruesome, doesn't it? The Jews called their scourging the intermediate death because it was less severe than the Romans. The custom in Palestine was to administer to the prisoner 40 stripes save one, so 39. Let me remind you by sharing a little about scourging or flogging, according to historians. Quote, "The scourging of Rome was more deadly. It was administered by a trained man called a lictor. He used a short circular piece of wood to which were attached several strips of leather. At the end of each strip, he served a chunk of bone or a small piece of iron chain, and this instrument was called a flagellum. There was no set number of stripes to be administered, and the law said nothing about the parts of the body to be assailed. Jesus was standing bent over a short column and tied to it securely. The flagellum was brought all the way back and whistled forward and made a dull drum sound as the strips of leather smashed against the back of the rib cage. The bits of bone and chain curled around the right side of the body and raised small hemorrhages on the chest, shoulder, or face." No doubt about it, this would be something absolutely horrendous to either dole out or to receive. In my mind, either end of that. Obviously, one far more gruesome than the other, but even the mindset to be able to do that to another human being is hard for me to wrap my mind around. Certainly, we certainly don't want to forget this, as it is true, and it helps us gain an understanding of the Father's and the Son's love for us. John, verse 4 of John chapter 19 says, "Pilate then went out and said to them again, Behold, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him." And Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." But the Jews, that wasn't good enough. The Jews answered, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid and went again into the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me?" Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you? And Jesus answered, you could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin. Yeah, the real blame goes on Satan. I'm sure Pilate was impressed with Christ's composure. Verse 12. From then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out. They were relentless, saying, if you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. And whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar. Now this got Pilate's attention because he did not want to lose his office. The crowd's words brought about the tipping point where Pilate finally stopped trying to spare Jesus Christ's life. Verse 16, he delivered him to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus and led him away. Think about this. He was never pronounced guilty by Pilate. He was simply handed over to be crucified. Christ was then nailed to the cross or the stake. The Passover lamb had offered his life. And after all of this, can anyone deny or doubt God's love for us? The Passover indeed has incredible meaning for us all. You know, we're told that we are to take and eat the bread of life, to which was once again puzzling for some to initially read, what do you mean the bread of life? And how does this represent you? There had to be this understanding that what they were about to partake of represented eating Christ's flesh. I mean, this is his broken body, represented his broken body, his spilled blood. There's so many things that weren't understood or appreciated at the time of the last and final hours of Jesus Christ's life that would sink in and resonate after the fact. There's much to take in when considering the final hours of Christ's life. Of course, the Passover is not the end. Jesus Christ was resurrected and ever lives to help us grow sufficiently spiritually so that we could become a part of his wonderful kingdom. We have 1 week left to think about and to prepare ourselves for the Passover. What an incredible sacrifice God the Father and Jesus Christ made on our behalf. I wish all of you a peaceful, spiritually enriching Passover service in a week, or just over a week, I guess I should say.